The tale begins basically as a teenage kid steals a ring from a jewelry store to impress his girlfriend.
Yeah, two misfit teenagers in 1921 in Atlanta, a city that was in the grip of crime, as the newspapers of the day described the situation. And it's kind of familiar to what we live with today in Atlanta. People were afraid to go to downtown Atlanta. There was too much crime in downtown Atlanta, too many undesirable youths in downtown Atlanta, doldrums of the economy, guns, flappers. And when this crime happened and this young man got away, when he was eventually brought back, he was the personification of what was bad in society, and he paid the price for it.
The story you tell turns into, well, it sort of reminds me of a Hollywood movie in a way.
Thank you. So what a wonderful idea.
Well, you've got narrow escapes, you've got nefarious characters, you got a femme fatale in a way.
Right. Betty Andrews.
Yeah, it's all in there.
As years have gone by, Betty has increasingly played the role of the villain, the temptress, the Eve. You know, she was the one who asked the immortal question, you know, would you get me a diamond ring? And Frank went out and stole it for her and killed a poor security guard in the process and shot another man as he raced down Peachtree Street. So Betty is a strange character. She told Frank she was a showgirl, and she had made that up. She was from Gainesville, and she had a very troubled childhood. Neither of these two teenagers were very bright. A psychologist described Frank as a high-grade moron, which was a term of use.
Medical time. Term, yeah.
And Betty also was described as a moron. So they were two misfit teenagers, but they became the talk of the town.
Somehow Frank Dupree escapes Atlanta, makes his way to Chattanooga, then to Norfolk, Virginia, I believe, then to Detroit.
Then to Detroit.
And he gets wrapped up in his own notoriety.
Yes, he does, because the newspapers, which followed the sleuths relentlessly, would always write that they just were a day late in Chattanooga, and they had a tip that he was in Norfolk. But when they went to, they set a trap for him in Norfolk, and he went to the Western Union office, and the pretty girl clerk, apparently, Frank said she fell for me, told him, beat it, that cops are over there. So he eluded them in Norfolk. Then he got to Detroit when he was finally tracked down. But as he was in Detroit, he's reading all these stories about him and what a great and canny thief this guy is. And he was being compared to General Nathan Bedford Forrest, the famous Confederate who struck and disappeared against the Yankees so many years before. And so Frank writes a letter back to Atlanta, to the Atlanta Constitution, taunting the police as a bunch of boneheads. And that letter continually reappeared during the trial as evidence that this guy is not deserving of any mercy.
What role did the papers play at the time? I mean, did they fuel a lot of the frenzy over this case? Because it became, you know, a sensational case in Atlanta and really got national coverage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did. And there was a lot of pressure on the Atlanta police at the time. They were perceived as a corrupt and inefficient organization. And Frank sending this bonehead, he lived in Atlanta for many years, so he knew of this. And he knew that the police were constantly under attack. So that in some way generated his letter. But the newspapers continually pressed them. You know, another day has gone by, and where's Frank Dupree? Because they knew who he was, and they knew he was on the run. And when he was captured, then he's brought back. They give front-page attention to the local preachers. John Wesley Ham, who preached at the Tabernacle, which is still downtown now, a music venue, but it was one of the largest congregations. And he basically went in his pulpit on Sunday morning before the trial began and said, look, men of Atlanta, since only men were considered for juries, the men of Atlanta who were chosen for this jury have to put an end to this. And basically called for the death sentence from his pulpit.
And that's what the prosecution wanted, too.
Yes. Good old-fashioned rope is what the prosecutor, Mr. Boykin, asked the jury for. Juries had incredible power under the law at the time. The jury could find an individual guilty, but with mercy, which means that they would go to prison, presumably, for the rest of their lives. But when the jury finally returned its verdict in this case, they came in and said, we find the defendant, Frank Dupree, guilty. And then everyone listened to hear whether there would be that recommendation, and there was none. So he was sentenced to hang 2 weeks after he was arrested. Speedy justice in 1922.
The case goes to appeal, and he loses that.
He loses on several grounds, jury prejudice and the judge's charge, some, you know, what we would call today technicalities, trying to have the case reviewed. That was never possible. Then it eventually goes to the governor, Governor Hardwick at the time, with the request for clemency, which, again, I think it's important to point out that Frank was white. And in Georgia, white people were hung in Georgia, but primarily the people who were hanged were African-American. And I think the motivation that brought so many women and public figures into this debate over whether this young man was deserving of mercy was generated by skin color.
The argument they used for clemency to the governor was that he was mentally retarded. He was deficient.
He was a high-grade moron, and he was just a young boy. As part of his whole criminal life, he was befriended, quote-unquote, by a Fagin-esque figure in downtown Atlanta, a gentleman by the name of Worth, who helped him hawk his rings. He had stolen rings before, and this gentleman had helped him meet a jeweler who would give him some money for the rings. And when he stole this fatal ring, again, he worked with this guy. So there was a feeling that this young, slow boy was being manipulated by adults who ended up being very lightly punished. And why was he being singled out? Why did he have to hang for this senseless crime? No one ever asked for mercy in the sense of, you know, well, let's give him another chance at society. They knew he would be put away for the rest of his life. And he was so young, that was another issue. People say, well, eventually he'll be paroled. But he had to hang.
Apparently there were quite a lot of people who signed a petition to save the man's life.
Yeah, 12,000, which is a...
And it fell sort of along gender lines, didn't it?
Yeah, primarily women. Primarily women were involved. They were called sob sisters and maudlin sentimentalists. And you know, he was a young and reasonably good-looking young man and very slight. And so whenever women... This was the way it was described at the time, anyway. When women saw him coming into the courtroom or getting off the train when he was brought back to Atlanta by the police, they would, oh, he's so slight, he's so small, he's such an innocent-looking young boy, I'd want to give him a hug. And that was sort of the male version was, you know, he's a cold-blooded killer, and the women said, oh, he's just a boy. So that was fueled the debate.
Let me ask you about hangings.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, in the Atlanta of 100 years ago, or close to 100 years ago, that was the preferred method of execution.
It was the method of execution.
And it wasn't carried out by the state, per se. It was carried out county to county?
Yeah. Well, judicial district to judicial district. There was a judicial district for Atlanta. And then in some of the more rural areas, the judicial district might cover 10 counties or something. But each judicial district was empowered with having a capital punishment trial for a person who was convicted of murder, rape, train wrecking was a capital crime. And then that county would, when they found the person guilty, set up a gallows. There were no more public hangings in 1922, but they would set up a gallows somewhere and hang a person. So Georgia doesn't even know how many people hanged, because if it didn't make the Atlanta papers, there's no central database for hangings. We know how many people were hung in Atlanta because they generally got at least a mention in the newspaper. But in, I'm just going to say, Cuthbert, Georgia, how many people hung down there? I don't know.
You have a photograph of the Fulton County Jail.
Yes.
And I got to tell you, when I saw that photograph and your description of what happened there, it looks like a building out of Central Casting.
Yeah, I mean, the tower.
The tower, yeah.
Yeah, that was courtesy of the Atlanta History Center, which allowed me to use that photograph. It's a grim-looking place. It was on Butler Street. I think it may have been removed for the downtown connector. But it was about five or six stories made of stone mountain granite. And then it has this bizarre, almost Italian tower that stands another five stories into the air where they could, I guess, presumably look for escapees or keep an eye on the populace, because it was in a rough part of town. And on the roof was a little structure where the gallows hook was built in when they built the place in 1898, and then the noose would hang down, and that's where the hangings took place in the Fulton County Jail, the tower.
When Frank Dupree was hanged, September, I believe, 1922.
September 1st.
It wasn't a public event, yet there were a lot of people drawn outside.
Mm-hmm. Similar to what happens today when there are executions when they were used to be conducted down in Jackson, or, you know, there would be crowds outside with candles supporting either the death penalty or, you know, grieving for the process. But it drew a crowd of probably 2,000 or 3,000 people, and they were on rooftops around. They had no view of anything. There was a little window on the structure where the gallows were located, where when the person walked down the hall to the gallows, they would get their last view of life outside the prison. And when Frank went by, people saw him, and they surged forward and made noises, and he waved and told his brother, "Boy, what a crowd."
To what extent did this case, the Frank Dupree case, his hanging, advance the movement to abolish the death penalty?
It started the first anti-noose league. People said that this is just wrong. We're picking individual, you know, case by case. This guy's going to hang for what somebody in another county would not hang. So there was a call to re-examine the death penalty. And surprisingly, you know, you would think everybody was for the death penalty back there. But when Frank was tried, the jury pool, about 1 in 3 of the men who were called for the jury said, I would never hang anyone. So there was a significant portion of the population, not a majority, but they opposed the death penalty. And what the Dupree case led to was a review of this whole process of county by county. There were also the subsidiary issue of lynching, which is a whole another subject. And the state decided, we're going to bring all these capital punishment cases under our roof. We're not going to go county by county, district by district anymore. Someone is going to die. We will put them to death, and we're going to end hanging, which was Georgia was one of the few, if not the only state still hanging, and go to the newly popular electric chair, which they did in 1924.
And what about the fact that Dupree was found to be mentally deficient? Did that have an effect on future capital cases?
No. Current situation now in Georgia, where there's a young man on death row with an IQ of 70. Frank Dupree's was 80, and he was considered a high-grade moron in 1922. So we have not yet in Georgia resolved that question. What do we do with people who are slow morons, to use the term of 90 years ago, who commit a violent crime and are sentenced to die? How do we deal with that? It was a point of discussion in 1922, and it still is in 2014.
Betty Andrews, whatever became of her?
She was eventually paroled in the custody of a clergyman. Frank had several clerical supporters. He converted to Episcopalian while in jail, and had a confirmation in jail, and preachers were with him at the end. And after Frank was executed, hanged, Betty was released in the custody of a preacher who said he would find her a home somewhere where her notoriety would not follow her. And it's kind of hard to trace Betty, but 10 years later, in the early 1930s, she married a military officer in Hot Springs, Arkansas, and she and Major Blaustein were married for, I guess, 30 years. She died in the 1950s in Amarillo, Texas, and she was known as Betty Blaustein, and she never, according to a boy who lived with them, was never formally adopted, but was related in some way. He said that she never discussed Frank Dupree. They never heard any of the many songs that the crime generated. And he didn't like her very much. He thought she was a nasty woman, but she died in Amarillo, Texas, in obscurity.
This is your second book that captures the life of Atlanta in the early 20th century through a sensational criminal trial.
Mm-hmm.
Writing about those sort of things, are you attracted because of the trial, or are you attracted because of what Atlanta was like at the time?
That's what I find most interesting, is the period detail. And you want something that that has some historical merit above and beyond the you know, day-to-day crime. This is a day-to-day crime. A snatched a ring, killed a guard. But what drew me to the story was the grip of crime, the sensational fear that crime had generated in Atlanta, downtown Atlanta, the way the clergy and the newspapers and the prosecutors all worked the case, and then the people who came forward to sort of question the need to execute this young man.
The Frank Dupree story lives on. In a way, because of the songs that were generated because of this case. And there have been many, haven't there?
There have. Right following the trial, there was a gentleman in Atlanta named Andy Jenkins, who's fairly celebrated in Georgia musical lore. He was a newspaper vendor, evangelist, who sang songs. He made up songs by the hundreds, many of them hymns. But he also made what he called news ballads. And he would sit down, and his stepdaughter would bang the thing out on the piano, and he would make these rather doggerel songs. And he wrote one about Frank, and that was the first. It was released on record. But the real Betty and Dupree musical legend is in the African-American blues tradition. Somehow, the story of Betty told Dupree, "I want a diamond ring," and Dupree told Betty, "I'll get you anything," was adapted by chain gang singers and scholars who went out and wrote down all these songs that were being sung out in roadhouses and chain gangs. And by 1930, there was a traditional song, a bad man ballad, about Frank and Betty and how Frank made a mistake, did a terrible thing for the jelly roll, which was a term for, you know, lovemaking. And that was the tradition which has spawned the Betty and Dupree, Betty Told Dupree, the Dupree Blues, which is still being recorded, still being performed by blues musicians as recently as, you know, as today. I'm sure you could find a club somewhere in Atlanta tonight where somebody would, if you yelled it out, they might play it.
Betty told Dupree she wanted a diamond ring. Betty told Dupree she wanted a diamond ring. And Dupree said, "Betty, I'll give you most any old thing." Now he didn't want Betty to know he didn't have a thing. Now he didn't want Betty to know he didn't have a thing. So he killed that jewelry man to get Betty that diamond ring. He got in a taxi, went down to Memphis, Tennessee. He got in a taxi, went down to Memphis, Tennessee. When he got there, detectives was waiting for Dupree. They took Dupree and carried him to that Big Rock jail. They took Dupree and carried him to that Big Rock jail. He didn't have nobody.